Hi there. It's time now for your friendly neighborhood economist, the show where you'll hear what's going on with the economy locally, nationally, and internationally, explained to you in plain English. Promise. Welcome to your friendly neighborhood economist, show number 025, that old-time tax cut religion. This month, we'll hear the rest of my interviews with State Senator Cecilia Kacik, who it turns out really is a nice lady, and Yahya Madra of Boğaziçi University in Istanbul. But first, some news. It's just going to be local news this month because my interviews are a little long. So beginning with the always popular municipal finance news, Greenport opened its new community center at 500 Town Hall Drive this past month, housing the police department on the first floor with the senior center and community center in the top floor, which is at ground level. It was an eventful month in the ongoing saga of the Caro-Durham School District as a crowd of more than 50 parents came to a public hearing on the fate of the Durham Elementary School. 1 week later, the Caro-Durham Board of Education decided to keep the Durham Elementary School open at another PAC meeting. However, at the very next meeting of the board, just 1 week later, one of the board members brought up consolidation to be reconsidered. Consolidating schools means Durham Elementary School shutting down. Stay tuned. In other consolidation news, Hunter Tannersville Central School District will share Catskill Central School District's cafeteria management beginning this month. In other school district news, Germantown Central School District had a vote about a proposal to set up a $500,000 capital reserve fund for renovations and repairs as needed. Meanwhile, starting in the fall, Hudson City Schools will be offering free meals to all students with funds from the Federal Healthy Hunger-Free Kids Act of 2010. Hudson City schools are eligible due to the high proportion of students from low-income families. Speaking of funds from elsewhere, Senator Kacik announced that the Haines Falls Free Library and the Hermans Memorial Library in Coxsackie are getting funds for renovations, and the Churchtown Fire Company got over $80,000 from the Department of Homeland Security. Meanwhile, the city of Hudson and the towns of Hillsdale and Kinderhook are looking for ways to fund road and sewer repairs and upgrades. You may have noticed some sinkholes in Hudson over the last couple of months. Moving on to an issue that's been much in the news, and that's about Pine Haven in Columbia County. Despite a petition campaign, it appears that the Pine Haven nursing home will not be converted into a veteran center. Incidentally, Columbia County is the only county in the state with no homeless veterans, according to Gary Flaherty, director of Columbia County's Veterans Service Department. The Columbia County Board of Supervisors laid out the problems with Pine Haven's financial situation in meetings over the last month. The problem is not caused by paying the staff well and will not be solved by privatization. The privately run facilities they looked at did not have very much lower labor costs, although they did show signs of fewer care staff. I bet that adds up to managers getting paid a lot, but I'm cynical. There are some variable sources of revenue from the state and federal governments, and the rest has to be made up with fees and county support. This is another example of the negative consequences of the tax cut religion we've been more and more forced to live under for the last 40 years. County municipal budgets are being further and further strained as the funding that used to come from broad-based federal and state taxes has dwindled, leaving property taxes at the local level to pick up the slack. And we've been seeing how that's been going. Nonetheless, the Board of Supervisors decided to open up a request for proposals for the sale of the Pine Haven facility to a, quote, private operator that will commit to Pine Haven's remaining in Philmont to preserve the number of residents at 120 and employees in the home, currently 200 full-time or part-time, and to offer new positions to Columbia County residents, unquote. In other words, the county thinks privatizing the thing is the way to go, or maybe, despite the lack of evidence for that. There was another resolution to continue building a new facility for $38 million, which was tabled. It's unclear to me why there's money to build a new facility but not to operate the current one. I'll have to find out more about that and get back to you later. Meanwhile, in energy news, residents of Canaan, Chatham, and New Lebanon are still waiting for details about Kinder Morgan's proposed Tennessee Gas Pipeline Northeast expansion that is apparently slated to go through the three Northeast Columbia County towns. The gas, apparently the output of hydraulic fracturing operations outside of New York, is destined for Massachusetts through a 30-inch high-pressure pipeline. Kinder Morgan plans to use existing rights of way that it has other pipelines on already. Meanwhile, the decision by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC, to create a new energy capacity zone in New York State, specifically in Hudson Valley, which will drive rate increases for electricity consumers in our listening area, is being contested in the U.S. Second Circuit Court of Appeals by the New York State Public Service Commission. So the PSC is suing the FERC. The new zone is intended to attract investment in new electric power plants by raising electric prices temporarily. Okay? So we're going to raise prices to get more plants in here. FERC's contention is that there is congestion, which requires new power generation capacity. The PSC argues that FERC is ignoring the governor's Energy Highway Initiative, which is also not very popular, I'm led to understand, but which is allegedly attempting to resolve the alleged congestion. Local political figures, including State Senator Cecilia Kacik, State Assemblywoman Dee Dee Barrett, and U.S. Representative Chris Gibson, have all voiced opposition to FERC's plan. Again, it's not clear where the congestion is that is supposed to be so urgent that everyone in the Mid-Hudson Valley must sacrifice. No one appears to benefit from addressing this urgent condition except the power companies that will make a lot of money by building stuff. Power lines, pipelines, power plants, etc. Meanwhile, far away in Washington, D.C., local residents brought their case for a carbon tax to the nation's capital. I'll be talking more about the relative merits of carbon taxes, cap and trade, or market-based carbon emission reduction schemes, as they're also known, and the Environmental Protection Agency's new proposed emission regulation next month. In local business news, one story that affects Columbia County businesses directly is the question of broadband access. The survey that the county carried out found out that the greatest unmet demand for broadband access is from small and in-home businesses. Most of the folks without broadband are on dial-up. It's unclear whether or not this includes mobile dial-up, which is very expensive and has low data caps. It's your phone's data plan, if you're wondering, essentially. Ken Flood, Columbia County's Planning and Economic Development Commissioner, says that he's working with two private companies, ECC Technologies and Integrated Systems, to design a broadband feasibility study for the county. Perhaps he could use some of the funds he won't be wasting on an airport expansion for installing broadband in the county. The Route 66 Food Mart will likely reopen by the end of summer after the fire started by an ex-employee, now current detainee. The new Price Chopper opened in Ghent, twice as big as the old one and with twice the number of employees. Three Columbia County farm families have been working with Scenic Hudson and the Columbia Land Conservancy to conserve more than 250 acres of farmland in Livingston with $1 million of support from the U.S. Department of Agriculture Natural Resources Conservation Services, which was matched by Scenic Hudson. Harney & Sons have bought the former Emsig Button factory located on 2nd Street in Hudson. No details yet about what they're going to be using it for, though. Two proposals for booze, a small distillery and a microbrewer in the town of Claverick, were heard this past month. The would-be distiller will receive a public hearing this month. The other, an operation proposed for his father's garage, will be heard by the Zoning Board of Appeals. Plans for Ginsburg's site on 30 acres given to the company by the county have been met with both local resistance and support. The critiques of the plans have to do with light pollution and the potential eyesore factor in the finished site. Since the boards of Ghent and Claverack rezoned the parcel gifted to Ginsburg's to industrial, it's not hard to imagine why the site plan is, well, industrial. But it would be good if the site could be designed to be as minimally invasive as possible. That's all the news for this month. I'll have more next month. Like any fat, it retracts before.
soaked with the tears because the baby's life has been revoked. The bond is broke, got so choked up and focused on the close up, missed all wheels, I can't reform. No God like Hocus Pocus, so don't sit back, kick back and watch the world get bushwhacked. News that's in your neighborhood is under attack. Put away the crack before the crack put you away. You need to be there with
That was Smash Mouth with Walking on the Sun. Now here's the rest of my interview with State Senator Cecilia Kacik. So where do you stand on the overall project, the energy superhighway or whatever it is that the governor wants to see? So the general idea is to bring all this energy from upstate down to the city. Is it clear that the city actually needs this energy?
No, it's and that's a good point. And I brought that up in my letter to the PSC. It's not clear that we need to do this process, and that seems to be issue number one. If it's not needed, why are we doing all this disruption potentially to help downstate? And that has not been clear. I don't think that issue has been clearly made so far to date. So, you know, and we've weighed in on that particular point. And you're right. If we don't need it, why are we doing it?
There was a story not too long ago in the Times about a separate project that's already done to bring power from New Jersey underneath the East River. No, actually the Hudson. And they're having difficulty finding demand for the energy that they're bringing in that way. There's been some speculation, at least by me, but also by others, that it might have to do with the governor wanting to shut down Indian Point. Do you have any ideas about that?
Well, he has not shared that with me.
In your daily morning lunch meeting?
No, so I really can't comment on, you know, what he's thinking and proposing down the road. But I don't think the need is being articulated and proven to be there for us to disrupt and, you know, inconvenience upstate so that we can get electricity downstate. And that's number one. You have to really identify that there is a need that can't be addressed without doing this project. So that's hurdle number one that I see the PSC having a hard time establishing. So we'll see.
Well, every time I see, you know, images of the garish advertisements in Times Square, I think it's just all worth it.
You know, we should talk about conservation and you know, maybe there's ways that they can save and reduce the amount of energy that they're using in Times Square and elsewhere in the city. And I think, you know, it's a mistake to just look at more, let's provide more supply without also looking at, let's make sure we're conserving and, you know, not wasting electricity also.
So I wanted to ask you where you saw the way forward for the economic development of the five counties in your district and for the state in general.
Well, my area is very rural and suburban. I have two small cities, Amsterdam and Kingston, and I cover a small portion, very small part of Schenectady. The rest is all pretty rural and small towns and villages. And one of the issues that comes up all the time is rural broadband access, making sure that people from their homes can access the internet. And if you can't access high-speed internet service, you can't work from home. And no one wants to buy your home, and businesses don't want to move in because so much is done on the internet. connecting with consumers, connecting with research, doing work from home. That to me will do more to expand economic activity upstate than anything else. It's also a way to help our schools get stronger in the ability to provide adequate education when they can do more distance learning classes. Some schools can't do much distance learning because they don't have the internet speed capacity. So there's definitely a technology infrastructure that the state needs to help support and build. That's number one. Our agricultural backbone of this district is very important. We have 28 school districts. We have a lot of farmers who are supporting them because a lot of our school funding comes from property owners. So I have a lot of property owners who are farmers paying a lot of those school budgets. And they're often property rich and cash poor. So every time we cut state aid to our schools, we're increasing low property taxes on our farmers and our other business owners and property owners. So fighting for equitable and fair distribution of school aid helps reduce local property taxes and makes it easier for businesses to move in and get going. We also need to support our farmers. And I'm really talking about small family farms and people who want to get into farming. And I was glad to see in this budget, because it's something I've been advocating for, there's a grant program to provide funding to people who want to get into farming. We have the next 20 years, like 70% of our farms are going to change hands. And we may lose a lot of small family farms in the process because they can't transfer their farm to the next generation. Mm-hmm. There's this huge focus on local food production and trying new models of getting food to consumers. And we have a huge appetite for food just downriver, and supporting our farmers to be more productive and grow more foods that are purchased by you and I, or being parts of models where we can connect farmers with their consumers more directly so that they don't have to go through a store, gives them more profit and more ability to grow what we want to eat. And people want to know who's growing their food, that it's being grown, and the people who work there are being treated fairly, and the animals are being treated humanely. People care about their food. So I'm seeing, that's to me is very exciting, that there's this movement in that direction. The new Ag and Markets Commissioner, Richard Ball, I'm very excited about. He's my neighbor and a friend. And he ran a produce farm. And he was instrumental in helping to create a CSA, it's called the Corbin Hill CSA project. And some folks from the South Bronx actually bought a farm in the Schoharie Valley with the idea that they were creating a CSA. They bought a hilltop old dairy farm. Mm-hmm. So you're not going to grow anything up there but rocks. So there were all these vegetable farmers down in the valley. Richard was one of them. And they said, let's get together with you and provide produce that we're already growing as part of your CSA. They now help fill there's like 20 farms that fill a tractor trailer load of produce that's driven to the South Bronx every week and feeds over 1,000 families. And also provides food in soup kitchens and homeless shelters and low-income housing projects. And it's Schoharie Valley farmers, you know, feeding people in the South Bronx. He's now the new Ag and Markets Commissioner. Mm-hmm. So he's been part of this movement of trying to connect farmers with consumers. And he tells a great story about the same carrots he's putting in that tractor trailer load to feed folks in the South Bronx are the same carrots that go to a high-end restaurant in Manhattan. And he says that with a smile. So mm-hmm. there's, you know, I see a lot of opportunities for growth in that industry to help, you know, develop our economies upstate. When we grow more food locally, we're creating more jobs, and that dollar is cycling locally over and over again. So I want to see more of that. Anything we can do to support small businesses, I'm going to be there to support. We've helped a lot of small businesses in the area either get access to funding, know what funding they're that's available for them, and to connect them with organizations that do low interest loans. Anything we can do to support that effort, you know, we need to do. Clearly, we need to do more, and that's why I'm excited about my reelection campaign and hope that the voters send me back to the Senate, because we have, while I've done a lot in the first 18 months, there's so much more that I need to work on, and my attitude, okay, we got that done, what's next? And clearly, we can't get the state to be responsive to the voters and our communities unless we get some of the influence of money out of the political process. So there's a lot we need to change systemically so that we can get government to work more for the people. And that's overall something that I think will do more to help us help our communities than anything else.
So with the governor's recent statement that he's going to do what he can to overturn the Independent Democratic Caucus, the IDC, to get them out and get some Democrats who will caucus with the Democrats in the Senate, do you feel very hopeful about positive outcome from that?
You know, all I can say is I'm focused on my district and being the best senator that I can for my district and letting, you know, the voters know that I have their back and they have someone they can count on, that I'm the one they want to send to the Senate. What happens in other races, and we have an election and things are very close numbers wise in the Senate, in my opinion, you know, anything can happen. I'm certainly appreciative of the governor's interest in wanting to see more Democrats get elected. Hopefully the voters will make sure I'm one of them that goes back to the Senate this year, and we'll see what happens. But it's hard to say, you know, what's going to happen until the election season is done.
Fair enough. So anything else you wanted to add before we wrap up?
Well, I'm just really excited to be the senator for the 46th Senate District. I'm inspired every day by the people that I meet, that, you know, there's so much we can do when we work together, because we have to make sure that the government works for the people, that we do common sense legislation that helps our communities, helps our schools, helps our families. And I'm excited to be part of that process. So I hope the voters recognize that. And if people have a question about my policies or want information, that they are welcome to call my office. I have three of them, one in Albany, we have one in Kingston, and one in Amsterdam in Montgomery County. So please check out my website and connect with us if you have an opinion. There's only 2 weeks left of the legislative session. There will be a lot of bills going through. So if there's something you particularly want to weigh in on before session is over, you know, now's the time to do it.
And I'll put links to your Senate page in the show notes for this show.
Great.
Listeners can find it there on my website.
Great. Well, thanks for having me on. I really appreciated the opportunity to speak with you.
Thanks so much for taking time out of your schedule to talk with us.
My pleasure.
Quando o Pero Vasco Caminha descobriu que as terras brasileiras eram verdes e verdejantes, escreveu uma carta ao rei. Tudo que nela se planta, tudo cresce e floresce. E o Gauss na época gravou.
Sobre a cabeça os aviões, sobre os meus pés os caminhões, aponta contra os chapadões meu nariz. Eu organizo o movimento, eu oriento o carnaval, eu inauguro o monumento no planalto central do país. Viva a bossa, sa, sa, viva a palhoça, sa, sa, sa, sa. Viva a bossa, sa, sa, viva a palhoça, sa, sa, sa, sa. O monumento é de papel, crepom e prata, os olhos verdes da mulata, a cabeleira esconde atrás da verde mata, o luar do sertão. O monumento não tem porta, a entrada é uma rua antiga, estreita e torta, e do joelho uma criança sorridente, feia e morta, estende a mão. Viva a mata, ta, ta, viva a mulata, ta, ta, ta, ta, ta.
viva mata, ta, ta, viva mulata, ta, ta, ta, ta. No pátio interno há uma piscina com água azul de amaralina. Coqueiro brisa e fala nordestina e faróis. Na mão direita tem uma roseira, autenticando a eterna primavera. E nos jardins os urubus passeiam a tarde inteira entre os girassóis. Viva Maria, ai, ai, ai. Viva Bahia, ai, ai, ai, ai, ai. Viva Maria, ai, ai, ai. Viva Bahia, ai, ai, ai. No pulso esquerdo, bang bang, em suas veias corre muito pouco sangue, mas seu coração balança um samba de tamborim. Emite acordes dissonantes pelos 5.000 alto-falantes. Senhoras e senhores, ele põe os olhos grandes sobre mim. Vive Iracema, mamá, vive Ipanema, mamá, mamá. Vive Iracema, mamá, vive Ipanema, mamá, mamá. Domingo é o sino da bossa, segunda-feira está na fossa, terça-feira vai a roça, porém o monumento é bem moderno, no dicionário do modelo do meu terno, que tudo mais vá pro inferno, meu bem, que tudo mais vá pro inferno, meu bem. Viva a banda, da, da, Carpe Miranda, da, da, da, da. Viva a banda, da, da, Carpe Miranda, da, da, da, da. Viva a banda, da, da, Carpe Miranda, da, da, da, da.
That was Caetano Veloso with Tropicália, which is in a couple of ways a nod to the World Cup happening in Brazil right now. I'll be watching Brazil play Germany in the semifinals later today as this is broadcast. Hope you'll join me. Caetano Veloso is, of course, one of the more well-known Brazilian musicians of the 60s and 70s, but Tropicália, in addition to being the title of this song, is the name of a particular type of protest music that arose in Brazil in the 1960s and 70s, especially in opposition to the military dictatorship. The memory of that dictatorship is what many Brazilians have been recalling while the current government has been preparing for the World Cup by displacing dirt-poor informal neighborhoods known in Brazil as favelas for venues or even parking lots, and spending billions on football stadiums in the Amazon instead of on the very real and urgent needs of the people. That's what the protests in Brazil have been about as the World Cup started. Moving our attention to Turkey, we'll now hear the rest of my interview with Yaya Madra of Boğaziçi University in Istanbul, in which Yaya tells us about the environmental impacts of Prime Minister Erdogan's economic development strategies and their relation to the protests that erupted around Gezi Park in Istanbul. We were talking about the construction of the Bosphorus, the second Bosphorus. Right.
Exactly, yes. So actually it's a whole set of projects, as we were talking about. Maybe there is actually the third bridge that's up north, mm-hmm. which requires destruction in order to build the roads that are leading to it. Requires destruction of the last remaining forest, the northern forests, mm-hmm. And that's a major ecological disaster, and for Istanbul especially. Secondly, there will be an airport that's built there. But most recently, I read something interesting about this third airport. It's within the domain of the first airport. So it's really not going to be that efficient, right? They will have to close down the first one to actually use, because it's so close to one another. They use the same lines that are landing in. Uh-huh. So, and there are very good research and analysis that are done in terms of, you know, there is something called environmental impact reports that you need to do in order to do these big projects.
Right.
So, talking about corruption, you know, sort of, yes, there might be big corruption, as we've seen in the last couple of months with all these ministries. But at a more micro level, we have all sorts of interesting things happening regarding these environmental impact reports. They are done in a very shoddy manner. So talking about corruption, you know, yes, there may be big-scale corruption, but also there are much more important, I believe, sort of problems with the way in which these types of environmental impact reports are done, mm-hmm. so that these large-scale projects are implemented without any opposition. So the third airport also had a very bad, there's a very good research done by a colleague here, Emre Haydunanat, that went through the entire process monitoring it, sort of looking at how shoddy it has been done. And the third big project is, of course, the third one is, of course, connecting the airport and the bridge, the highways, and then the highways will have exit and entries where around those sort of 19 of them, there will be, of course, immediately urbanization will begin, construction will begin after a while. That's what happened in the second big bridge. So the city will grow to the north. And the third real big project is the Channel Istanbul, crazy project as Erdogan calls it. And all of these indicate a kind of, if you like, an attempt to push the growth forward, so to speak, with these big infrastructural projects. I mean, it is, of course, there is an authoritarianism also building up in Turkey. So a significant level of police brutality is what we've been observing for the last couple of years. Mm-hmm. Police has become the more important force compared to the military. That doesn't mean that military is sort of out of the picture, but they're out of the picture in terms of immediate intervention in the politics, at least for the moment being. But they have all the sort of war excitement with Syria and with also sort of, there's a peace process right now, but we never know how that will unfold in the coming years. Sure. But police is the sort of most important component of the security apparatus. But what I'm saying, what does that remind? Of course, there's the New Deal as well, this type of big projects, this Keynesian sort of infrastructural investments, if you like, this big G, so to speak, yeah. can serve various different purposes. And in this case, it is serving the kind of a new Istanbul being built, a new construction sector being built. Perhaps the most significant implication of this is that Turkey is going to continue to grow if it is going to be able to finance this construction, mm-hmm. sort of, and keep it rolling in the next couple of years as well. But the quality of that growth will be the same. It is not going to be a growth in the form of a environmentally sort of sane, technologically innovative, high value-added products, but actually sort of construction, which is which is of course also prone to sort of bubbles,
right?
As we've seen.
So we talked about the energy projects, the infrastructure projects, and the final leg of this construction stool, I guess, really is the housing construction that's been going on, right? Especially in and around Istanbul and the other cities.
Yes. So, that is also sort of very much state-led, even though what we learned from these recent corruption charges is that there are certain new emerging bourgeoisie, new emerging capitalists, who are around the state, which is not a new thing in Turkey. Turkey was always, after the Armenian genocide, had to create, not only Armenian, but non-Muslim groups genocide in 1915, after the republics established in 23, had to create its own bourgeoisie, basically, because part of it was also reappropriation of wealth for the Muslim population, mm-hmm. Muslim Turkish population. So that's a long history, and now we're seeing yet another stage. Now, this time, a kind of a more religious and conservative capital that is being emerging, and that capital is sort of in coalition, if you like, with the government and with the Erdogan government. And in a way, the TOKİ, the central agency for housing, is actually working in various projects, private-public partnership projects, in building these housing projects. Now, part of this housing in Istanbul, for instance, is justified because of the threat of earthquake. And there's a law that they passed, which is kind of a similar to eminent domain law in the United States, which actually appropriates land and houses, basically claiming that this is dangerous. So either you rebuild this house, so people living there may not have the money to do that, so they either get some credit, or if they cannot, they basically sort of accept the deal as proposed by the sort of government. And therefore, they go to these housing projects, right? And a lot of gentrification projects in certain very historically interesting, yet sort of populated by relatively poverty-stricken communities. So mm-hmm. they got displaced. For instance, Roma community in one of the most interesting parts of the town got displaced into really, really outside of the city. To a new housing project, which will later on be on the coast of maybe new Boazici, right? New Bosphorus, if it's built. So we don't know, of course, sort of how it will develop. But some argument is that earthquake, and the other argument is, of course, there's a demographic shift. I mean, there is actually migration to the city, so we are increasingly observing an emerging sort of industrial reserve army in the cities. So that those people need to be settled into places, as well as also those sort of previous generations who came and settled into shanty towns, now moving up perhaps into these high rises with these sort of, they're not high quality high rises, but these type of sort of big buildings with small units. Some of it is actually maybe that. Yes, projects, so to speak. I mean, maybe there is actually a demand for it, maybe to a certain extent. But on the other hand, recent data
really high, aren't they?
In Istanbul, yes, yes, rents are very high, exactly. So, but in Istanbul, rents are high if you want to be in the inner city. So Istanbul. So one of the other projects they've been doing, so that's another part which we have to, in fact, the main line for their local elections just this March was basically the subway system and the public transportation system. Now, it's not enough, and part of the injustice within the urban area comes from there, that is, if you want to stay in a place where you can get anywhere easily, you pay a very high rent. If mm-hmm. you go outside, then you have limited access to the city. In fact, they never come to the center of the city. So these sort of subway projects, these sort of the channel that goes under Marmara, these are all Bosphorus connecting two sides, Europe and Asia. These are all projects that actually sort of the blue chip projects, if you like, of the governing party. And they use this in the elections. And it's actually kind of also representing a kind of a part of this whole project of building up a new big city, right? You know, sort of. You know, they are building up a middle class. As much as possible. Middle class, a euphemism, of course, a working class, right, urban proletariat, but with maybe somewhat of a, aspirations, right? In a way, this is kind of that infrastructure that is being built. That's a vision of development, actually. That's a vision of development that they have. Without really much concern about the environmental impact, without really much concern about good life in the city, so all of these things are kind of a kind of very impoverished vision of development, I would argue, in certain ways, like a very kind of commodity-led, basic infrastructure kind of vision.
Right. So it's not a very sustainable model for. Development of the Turkish economy, but it's also meeting with a lot of popular resistance, right? Especially, so this basically brings us to Gezi Park and the kind of straw that broke the camel's back, so to speak. Why don't you talk about that a little bit?
Well, Gezi is, of course, today, I mean, I see your sign, we want a just society, not police brutality behind. Gezi is actually a kind of a very overdetermined incident. And I think one of the most important things is that within that conjuncture, so there are the big picture, and the big picture is this whole turbulence of capitalist accumulation that we've been observing, the type of capitalist accumulation, and the effects that it has been having in Istanbul. So Istanbul is a major sort of site for this sort of transformation, and it causes dislocation in the society. So that's one big thing, of course. And the ecological implications, Gezi was one of the first in Turkey ecologically based uprising. It started from an ecological concern, right, protecting a park from being demolished. But also it is the police brutality, right? The police brutality at the security apparatus, which is very, very much important for this government. It's alternative to the military, of course, in certain ways. And it is sort of at a level increasingly mechanized, gas bombs, you know, sort of water cannons and so on and so forth. So there's like very heavy-handed intervention, and we're gearing up to tomorrow, where this interview is on April 30th. Tomorrow is May 1st, and it is once again it's going to be a major thing, because they shut down again Taksim Square, where Gezi Park is, so the workers cannot converge there, but workers decided to do so. So there's going to be clashes. So everyone in Istanbul basically getting ready for that.
Right.
So that's an important aspect. And I think something that is usually not considered in the debates, but in this project about the website that we did for the popular economics website that we have, maybe we can share it on the website of the, the link on your website.
Show notes.
Yes. There we noticed something which is really remarkable. The unemployment among youth is between 20% and 25% in Turkey. And this is actually a major sort of insecurity. So a lot of people who were there were youth, and they were actually across class. So it was not just working class kids who were there, but also it was sort of white-collared young people who were there perhaps for ecological concerns, who were there perhaps for other forms of discontent from the transformation of the city. And also, of course, there is this sort of conservative attempt of a regulation of the life. I mean, for instance, in the United States, some of these things are kind of received in form of a neoliberal Bloombergian sort of intervention into health, right? Mm-hmm. This is a kind of new phase of neoliberalism. It's biopolitics, right? Politics about life. So you shouldn't smoke, you shouldn't drink after a certain hour, and you know, you should control your drinking of Cokes and so on and so forth. So in Turkey, there is a similar vein, but this time added color of religious conservatism, right? So controlling
all the US.
Well, yes, you do, but in Bloomberg case, you don't. I mean, in fact, if you go south in U.S., you can have much more free atmosphere in terms of cigarettes and alcohol, perhaps, right? Southern states are relatively more relaxed in terms of those. So here, kind of, religion is actually playing in a way, kind of converging with the, so to speak, the Bloombergian project. Or uses the Bloombergian project to make sure. So that actually also a lifestyle issue kind of motivated some people. And also there is actually a gender structure in the society which is quite brutal. There is a very increased number of domestic violence. Mm-hmm. And also labor force participation among women is today 30%. Among men is 70%. So that's a major gap. And one interesting thing is that at least the data in the Turkstat would say that throughout the last decade, it went from 20% to 30%. So this is actually a gain, that there's an increased labor force participation of women, but of course, what sort of labor force participation? And that labor force participation is creating perhaps certain dislocations in the household, because both parents are now working, and that creating certain new contradictions. So Gezi was partly a woman's uprising as well. So it's actually kind of, you know, in Turkey, women has certain rights that were there since the early days of the Republic, but there is actually a deeper conservatism in the society. And in a way, sort of Gezi uprising was partly also not only ecological, not only in terms of capitalist accumulation, not against police brutality, but also for gender violence and gender structures in the society, I think. So all of those things kind of, in a way, converged in an overdetermined, like combustion, as you said, or happened. Certain things come out of it is that, I think, which is coinciding with the Kurdish sort of liberation movement and their demands for democratic autonomy. And one of the important things that Kurds have been demanding recently is that local governance to be more on the forefront. Right? They are advocating sort of communes among neighborhoods, sort of youth communes, women's communes, and all these communes are governing themselves, like in a kind of a more like self-governance structure. There are even some parallels that are given with the Zapatistas in certain structure. Suddenly, in the west of Turkey, everyone said, why do we have to listen to a prime minister dictating us what to do about a park in the middle of our city? Yeah. So suddenly the central government and Istanbul had a relation that Diyarbakir, Kurdish city, had with central government. Like today, everyone is very upset about the governor, which is assigned from the central government, from Ankara. If in Diyarbakir, they've been very upset about it because it's the colonial governorship, they see it. Yeah. And now Istanbul is feeling like, or Izmir or other places, look, why do we have a central government agency that is determining what we should be doing in the city,
right?
So, so this type of a localization or decentralization of governance is actually put on the agenda after Gezi. That's one important thing, I think. And of course, it also create a kind of a frontier much more clear in the society between the Erdogan and his sort of populist front and a counter-populist front against that. Interestingly, you know, the division in the society resembles the way that Venezuela is divided in certain ways. Not the content of the sides, but the division, right? Yeah. The sort of polarization, so to speak. This is not to say Erdogan is like a Chavez, like a figure. Of course, he has some redistributory mechanisms, but he's also a very kind of close working with neoliberal capitalist accumulation process, right? You know, sort of. He does have certain redistributory sort of concessions, and sort of that's how he, in a way, forms his populist front, but that polarization is how one can describe that, perhaps in that sense.
So looking forward a little bit now, where do you see? Well, what do you think the chances are of Erdogan's party maintaining control, given the corruption and the popular resistance? And what do you see if they can't maintain, you know, a governing coalition, what do you see replacing them? And to what extent will the popular resistance to Erdogan's regime survive a transition to something else?
Well, that's a very difficult question. What we are observing right now is that with the, if I'm not mistaken, you know, in Federal Reserve is sort of tightening its monetary policy, right? That's
bit.
We are moving
They're
towards
not
a tight.
Finding as many assets.
Yeah. Yes, so that's actually going to, sorry.
The what they're doing is tapering, right? So every month they're buying $10 billion less in assets than they have been doing.
Yes. So that's going to have an effect on Turkish economy because there's a, as we said perhaps in the earlier hour, that all this sort of construction, etc., depends on net capital inflows. There's a major current account deficit coming to 6%, 7%, oscillating around that, depending in the crisis year, it just collapsed, and therefore the growth collapsed, and unemployment went up to 15. So that's the major thing. That's what's held the government together. So now the thing is that government just released that they are going to guarantee from the Treasury any big project. That's a major thing. That they just sort of, this is actually very 180 degrees turn from IMF's requirements, structural adjustment requirements, where government doesn't give this type of open pocket to big boon projects. Now, they said, we will support them. The reason why they did that, because they weren't able to finance these big projects. So that's one thing. And Erdogan wants a low interest rate. Now, low interest rate means, of course, capital will leave, so that's a dangerous thing as well. So how is that going to be possible? That would mean that the currency will depreciate, and when the currency depreciates, the industry will be adversely affected because they use a lot of imported goods to produce domestic stuff. Yep. So they'll have to pay more expensive. So that low interest rate is actually, so he's actually making a choice there so that, you know, keep the economy going. And public is going to give more credits. The government is going to give more credits. So these three things, so the guarantee, the low interest rate, and credit is actually what they're leading for the next couple of years, which is the two big elections coming up. First, the presidency, and then the... So we are entering into kind of a year and a half long basic sort of spending theory. And that perhaps will take it through the election, and then there will, then he's thinking, I'll think about it after the election. The only sort of reason that it can do this is because for the last 10 years, actually, Turkish government, with the exception of 1 year, has been giving a primary surplus.
Right.
It has been paying its interest payments, so the government's position is pretty good. The budget position is pretty good. We're just releasing those information on our website this week, and you'll see the primary surplus pretty clearly there. So that's actually one of the reasons why they've been getting good ratings as well. But what I've been observing is that some of the banking system getting now lower ratings. So the credit is going to actually slowly going to leave. And in terms of construction, we talked about bubble, especially housing. What we observed prior to the election, first 3 months, there was very little sale. There was a huge drop. And the companies were saying, this was a news just a couple of days, was saying that's because of the election, and they were hoping that it would resume back in April. But what I read this past on Sunday on a newspaper, that nothing much happened since the election, which is the beginning of the month. So I don't know. I mean, that may be just a conjunctural thing, and then the sales will resume again. I don't know. But seeing all of this coming, the government is right now going to open up their sort of budget, like they're going to spend sort of in different ways. So that means with also the ideological consistency of the party, like 43%, my sense is that we're going to have Erdogan in the next 5 years, either as a president, if he doesn't like the conditions of that, as a prime minister. Because president is not exactly the president as in the United States, a bit narrower in terms of its sort of structure. My hope as a kind of a person of a broadly defined left is that perhaps one way is electoral politics, right? That's a path. But another path is to sort of keep on organizing at a local level.
Right.
sort of thinking about sort of building up alternative economies, both in Istanbul, also helping as much as possible what's happening in Kurdistan, because there is actually a much more explicit sort of declaration of intent in order to build a kind of a communal solidarity economy, community economy in the Kurdish provinces with the help of the municipalities. Mm-hmm. Now, that's a whole other conversation because there are also interesting contradictions there as well. But these types of local community economy solidarity, we can actually perhaps, okay, do the work at a more sort of ground level within this conjuncture, or at least keep on doing that. Because at the more aggregate level, the political parties that are opposing Erdogan are not really opposing Erdogan on its economic project, on his economic project. That type of neoliberal developmentalism, with various small differences, are still going to be on their agenda. The difference might be in the lifestyle issues and in the kind of perhaps the use of police brutality and all of those, at least for the Republican People's Party, has been on the one side of the stick for too long now. So they may actually, when they come to power, they may have a different attitude. I don't know, but at least that's what they're saying at this stage. But in terms of economic policy, that's not going to be a major change. So that's my sort of maybe less hopeful sort of, but realistic pictures of what's to come.
All right. Well, I think that's a good place to wrap it up. I just want to thank you again for coming on and sharing the situation in Turkey with our listeners. So, once again, I've been speaking to Yahya Madra of Boğaziçi University in Istanbul, in Turkey, and on the editorial board of Rethinking Marxism, a journal of Marxist thought published in the U.S. So thanks again, Yahya.
Thank you very much, Tom.
That's it for this month. Join me next month when I'll talk about carbon and wages and, of course, the news. This has been your friendly neighborhood economist. I can be heard on the second Tuesday of every month at 10 a.m. or at any time online. Check me out on wgxc.org. On Facebook, just search for your friendly neighborhood economist. On my new homepage at yfneconomist.blogspot.com, where I'll post show notes and links to the show. On my Tumblr blog at yfneconomist.tumblr.com, or on Twitter at yfneconomist. If you've got a question you've been dying to ask a sympathetic economist, ask me through one of these avenues or email me at yfneconomist@gmail.com. I'm always happy to hear and answer questions, so please send them in. Your Friendly Neighborhood Economist is a production of WGXC 90.7 FM, Acre, Catskill, Hudson, New York, and Thomas Masterson.